Thank you, ladies. So it's kind of funny. When we had our first alumni meeting in person, I guess it's like 3 weeks ago, and found out that we're going to do our first Friday, John was like, yeah, we need somebody to chair first Friday, but you're going to have to get your, I'll chair. He didn't even have to finish. You're going to get your own speaker. I was like, you know, I missed my January normal when I usually chair. And so, and I went home that night and I was thinking, I told Paul a couple of folks that I had in mind, and a name popped up in my head. And I have not seen, our speaker is Daniel, and I have not seen Daniel at all. Maybe at the grocery store. I think we saw at the Kroger parking lot sometime in the last 16 months. I couldn't tell you which month. They kind of all go together. And his name, he popped up in my head. I was like, oh my God. I've never heard his story. I've heard bits and pieces about him because we go to dinner. He's been to my house. I really want to hear his story. And so I texted him the next morning, and he's like, absolutely, no question. Didn't hesitate, you know, getting in front of all these people, nervous, telling your story kind of stuff. He did not hesitate. And I am real excited to hear what his story is. With that, I will give you Daniel H. Do I need to move that? Good.
Come around the front. You're going to sit on the stool. I'm good right here for right now. Hey everybody, I'm Daniel. I'm an alcoholic. Daniel. I'll probably move around quite a bit, so just bear with me. I said I stand. So it's just one of those things. Thank you, Dawn, for asking me to be here tonight. I really appreciate it. First off, I have my sobriety date is 7/24/2013. I first came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in July 2010, which was, when I say into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, actually my first trip into Ridgeview was in July of 2010, I stayed for the detox period. And somebody who's in here tonight said, you know, we really think you should stay. And I said, no, I'm good, you know, and I think I was back about 2 weeks later. So it didn't take long to find my place back here, and I continued to stay in the halfway house, but for me that still wasn't enough. So we'll get into all that, but a little bit about me. I'm 47 years old. I've got two wonderful children. I have a daughter that's 13, a son that's about to be 16 in about 20 days. And I grew up in Tennessee. I'm not a big whiskey drinker. Everybody's like, oh, you must love Jack Daniels. I can't stand it. And, you know, but alcohol is my drug of choice. I'm also an addict, but alcohol was always my go-to. For me, I grew up in a very small town in Tennessee. It's one of those towns where, you know, you really can't get away with anything, because as soon as you did something wrong, somebody's mama was on the phone calling your mama, telling them, you know, he's screwing up again, you know. So, which was kind of my story growing up. I got into a lot of trouble, and if I wasn't in trouble, in some way of my personal life, I was, you know, in school in trouble, and I did a lot of that. So I realized early that there was a lot going on, and I probably had something else to come. I took my first drink accidentally. My uncle played it on me as a joke, but I still remember it when I was about 5 years old. And it was Jack Daniels was the first drink that I had, and he thought it was hilarious, and I didn't. But then quickly thereafter, I was 5 years old, and I remember liking the effect that the alcohol produced. And he was kind of like, you know, I was like, you know, you got any more? And they were like, no, you know, you might not need that right now, you know. So, but that, you know, that was kind of a laughing deal at our Christmas party that we had. And you know, it would be another 9 years before I took my first drink by myself. And and that was my stepfather was a big drinker. And but he always marked his bottles, you know, because he always knew I was gonna go back to him, and he always told me, he goes, I marked those bottles, by the way, you know, so just be aware. And this was before I even drank, but I guess he knew what was coming, because he always made sure he told me that, so I wouldn't go and tap into those things. But I did it anyway, you know, because I'm an alcoholic, and that's what I'm gonna do. So I took that first drink when I was 14 years old. And I remember still, I still like that the effect produced by alcohol at that time, to the point to where it scared me. So I quickly put the bottle back, and one, out of fear, you know, from him, and two, out of fear of what I was experiencing at the time. Flash forward 2 years later, and I'm going out the first night with my boys, and the first thing I do is go to my dad's liquor cabinet and steal the same bottle or the same type of liquor that I drank that night. And not only did I get drunk that night, I smoked marijuana for the first time also. And man, I really liked you know, what it did, you know, not to me, but what it did for me. You know, I was one of the guys, you know, I grew up in this small town, and everybody drank in high school. Everybody had all these parties, and I just wanted to fit in, because I was so odd. I could never fit in. I wasn't comfortable in my own skin. Whoa, this thing moves a little bit. But anyway, so you know, immediately I realized I had a problem. But I'd always grown up, I come from a long line of alcoholics in my family. My mom always warned me when I was growing up, you know, your uncles are alcoholics, you know, your so-and-so's an alcoholic, you know, you just need to be aware this is in your family. But it never really dawned on me. I was like, I'll never be an alcoholic. I always thought alcoholics slept under a bridge or on the side of the road, you know. That wasn't going to be me. But, you know, my uncles didn't do that either, but they had that tendency. And I heard all the stories, and it just never dawned on me that that could happen. You know, that would be a part of my life also. You know, I fit in with my friends when we were drinking, but when I was sober, I couldn't associate with anybody. I just didn't fit in. I didn't want them to know me, and I didn't want to talk. I was awkwardly shy, but as soon as I drank alcohol, I could be anybody they wanted me to be. You know, I mean, all the world's my stage. You know, I'm whoever you need me to be. You know, and that was my life. The first time I blacked out, I went on a trip to Florida with one of our high school trips or whatever, and I remember I was in a room for 3 days. Everybody else was out on the beach drinking, and here I am blacked out in a room in a hotel. And I remember that whole trip back, everyone started treating me differently, because they knew, they all knew, and I knew it too, that I had a problem. So this continued, you know, I continued to get in trouble throughout high school and throughout college. I ended up, I always found a way, you know, I always found a way to get through. I managed to graduate from a pretty good Catholic high school in Tennessee. I ended up going to college, and you know, I just wanted to fit in and join a fraternity and you know, the drinking and whatnot. But you know, I also had, you know, the drug issue going on. But you know, I always wanted more, you know, and I did a lot of things in college that got almost got me into a lot of trouble. And I remember the one phone call that came in. I'd always heard about my Uncle Mark from our family, and he worked for what's known as the TBI up in Tennessee, which is the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. And I remember getting a phone call, I think it was like a Tuesday night, and I was in Knoxville, and my father called me and he said, "You got 24 hours to go get a U-Haul and pack your shit and get out of Knoxville or you're going to jail." And I had no idea how he knew what I was doing, but all I knew was is my stepdad. My dad left when I was 2 years old, but I eventually came to call my stepfather my dad, and he said, "I'm not going to say another word. I'm hanging up the phone. You better do what I say." So I went, got the U-Haul, packed up my stuff, and literally as I'm pulling off the block, the TBI surrounds the building and takes all my friends to jail except me. So, you know, I always seemed to get out of things like that. I never really had to pay a lot of consequences. I never got a DUI. You know, I did get arrested for public intoxication once when I was, you know, a little bit younger. But as far as legal situations, I managed to skate by with that by the grace of God. And God knows I should have gone to jail a lot. And I didn't, and I thank God to this day I didn't hurt anybody else in all my goings on out there. While I was in, I ended up going back to college a year later and finished up. And while I was in college, my family moved from Tennessee down to Georgia. We fast forward to like 1995, I was born in 1974. I'm sorry, I'm trying to go fast. I have a lot that I'm trying to get in, and I don't want to spend a lot of time with my qualifications or my past. But anyway, so I moved to Georgia, my drinking proceeded to get worse along with my drug career, and my use of drugs. But my addiction really took off when I came to Atlanta. I went through phases throughout that time where I'd stay sober for a little bit. When I mean a little bit, it was 6 months, 8 months at a time. But then I'd always go back to drinking, and then it gets worse, never better, every time you go back out. So that continued on, and then but during that time, during one of the spells when I was not drinking as much. I did meet the woman that I would eventually come to marry, and she was the mother of my children, and at the same time my career is progressing along. I work in the heavy equipment industry, but somehow some way, like we talked about in the book, my career proceeded to continue on. My alcoholism hadn't quite caught up to me just yet. So, we get married, have our son. My son, by the way, was born 7 weeks premature in July. He was July 27th of 2010. And I'm sorry, 2005, thinking about here. Anyway, and we'd come to find out he's autistic. He has Asperger's. So, you would think I would kind of straighten out for him and kind of pull it together, but I just could not stop drinking. I became a slave to alcoholism, and it just proceeded to get worse and worse. Throughout this time, my alcoholism, once it finally took hold and it got a hold of me and it really started to impact my career. I started to lose jobs. It put a strain on my relationships, not only with my family, but also with my wife. And finally, in 2010, I just had enough, and she had had enough of me. We separated, and I decided then I had a friend who had started to get sober. And she had kind of planted the seed in me, and I saw what was going on, the changes in her life, and the happiness that she had, and I was like, wow, that's something I really want, And so I made a decision that day that I was going to I was going to try and get sober. So I kissed my son goodbye and told him, I was going to try and go do this. And in the meantime, we also had a little girl that was born. She was 2 at the time. I told her that I was, she didn't understand at the time, thank the Lord, but hold on 1 second, I'm getting a little uncomfortable. Sorry about that. So I came to Ridgeview, like I said. I stayed for 5 days for the detox program, and then decided I was okay and decided I would leave. About the same time, while I was in Ridgeview, we found out that my father was diagnosed with ALS, and my father and I would go to a lot of ball games up in Knoxville quite a bit. He played football for the University of Tennessee. And on one of the last trips that we had up there, I noticed something was wrong. And while I was here, he went and got tested. And he told me while I was here that he had been diagnosed with ALS. And it was advancing rather quickly. I didn't have the willingness. I didn't have any desire to get sober. I just wanted to continue to keep drinking. I just didn't, no matter what. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And, I left my wife. I moved back home with my parents. My mom's trying to take care of my dad. He's going through ALS, and the man's dying right in front of me. Finally, I'm drinking from 2010 to 2011. Finally, in 2011, around March, my dad had gotten to the point with ALS that he couldn't speak anymore. He had a dry erase board that he would write on, and the software hadn't come out yet that they have now, where they can type on the keyboard and it speaks for him. I'd come downstairs, halfway sober, and he'd come downstairs and he wrote on a dry erase board, "Will you please just let me die in peace?" And that really bothers me to this day. And so I said, "Yeah, I will." And I called my friend and asked him if I could stay with him, and he said, "Yeah, sure. Come on." I didn't tell him what my dad said. I just told him I needed a place to stay. And so I went to his house and I stayed there. And 2.5 months later, I was there and continued to drink. This was my best friend. This was the man that was the best man at my wedding. I was drinking his alcohol, and he, if he left any money around, I would steal from him too, because that's the type of person I'd become. And my mom called me in the middle of the night in May of that month, and May 23rd, and told me that my father had passed away and I needed to come to the hospital. So I came to the hospital. At the same time, I had said my goodbyes to him, and we were having the service in Tennessee, and at the same time, I had been interviewing with a company in Tennessee where I'm from, and they actually extended a job offer to me. And this is how crazy and out of mind I was at the time. I'm coming out of my dad's wake and out of his memorial service at the church, and the insanity of the disease is where I'm trying to get at with this, and tell you where my state of mind was. And the employer called me and asked me, and offered me the job, and I told him, yeah, it sounds great. Hey, I'm at my dad's funeral service, let me call you back. And he's like, "Are you sure you need to be making this decision right now?" I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely, I want the job, I'll be there Monday." And he's like, "Why don't you take some time to think about it?" I'm like, "Nope, I'll be there Monday, and this is a Friday, And I proceeded to get drunk that weekend at my uncle's house in Tennessee, and took the job, left my kids, went to Nashville, and this is in May. keep in mind, my mom's grieving my dad's death. I'm a raging alcoholic lunatic, driving back and forth between Atlanta and Nashville to see my kids, drinking the whole way here, drinking the whole way back, not caring about anybody, anyone, anything that I had come in contact with on the interstate. I'm so thankful I didn't hurt anybody or kill anybody on those drives. It was a 4.5-5 hour drive back and forth between Nashville and Atlanta, and I didn't hurt anybody. I don't know what to higher power is that speaks for itself. Because God wasn't watching out for me. He was watching out for everybody else. So October rolls around. I had gone out one weekend. I told you I also had substance abuse issues. On top of doing a lot of alcohol, I had done a lot of another substance that night. And I did so much of it that it blew out my arterial vein in my leg. I didn't really realize it at the time what had happened. My body had gone into shock. But anyway, long story short, 4 days later, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't breathe at all. I didn't realize what was happening to me. The whole time, you know, while I'm going through all this pain, at the same time, I was still managing to get up. I had a friend, I called a friend and asked him to bring me a pair of crutches so I could get up. And the only reason why I wanted the crutches is so I could get to the liquor store. So my friend brought me the crutches. She left. She was like, please go to the hospital. You don't look good. I was like, I'm fine. I'm good, you know. I grab the crutches, I'm going to the liquor store down the street to get a bottle. My leg is shooting pain. It feels like I'm walking on glass, shards of glass going in my feet. And all I wanted to do was to get that bottle. I think I finished that much of it and shoved it under my couch because my sister told me when she was at the hospital later on that she found the bottle underneath the couch. And I told her to get out. But anyway, I'll get to that in a second. So my neighbor had just got home. His name is Cody. He's a police officer. He's on patrol. I heard him get home that night. I get to the door of the apartment, and I open the door, and all I could get out was his name, because when you have a pulmonary embolism, you can breathe in, but you can't breathe out. So I had enough in me to get his name out, and he said by the time I got to you, keep in mind my apartment door is from here to where Dawn's sitting right there, I was gone. I was out. I was fading, I'll say that. And I remember his wife coming out and saying, he's not going to make it. You need to put him in a patrol car and take him to the hospital right now. So he puts me in a patrol car. I feel him pick me up. He's a huge guy. We go to the hospital, and on the way there, I passed away. My soul leaves my body. I follow the police car all the way to the hospital. I had a white light experience at that time, which if you want to talk to me about that, we'll talk about that afterwards. And, you know, at another time, whatever. And, but you know, God wasn't ready for me to leave yet, you know? And I hope you're not offended when I say the word God. I really do. I've come to find through the spiritual experience that it talks about in the big book and the spiritual awakening that we have to have to become sober. That's my higher power, who I refer to as God. So I hope I don't offend anyone by saying that. I come back. You would think all that would be enough. But no, I just kept on. They took my leg. I went through a whole lot more. I ended up coming back. I was in a coma for 6 weeks. Got out of that. Was in ICU for probably another 2 or 3. Stayed another 2 or 3 weeks in a room. Finally, I came home December 22nd, and got better for about 4 or 5 months. Got a green light to leave. Started to go to some meetings, started to get sober, I think around April or May. I was back to drinking again that year. But anyway, I kept on. And then finally, it talks about in the big book on the bottom of page 30, it says, says, we alcoholics are men and women who have not, who have lost, who have, I'm sorry. All of us felt at intervals usually brief, were inevitably followed by still, I don't have my glasses. Anyway, bitter and incomprehensible demoralization. That's what I'm trying to get at. That's what I felt. Sorry. I brought my glasses. They're in my pocket. I'm afraid if I grab them, I'm going to fall over, and it's just not going to end well. But anyway, so I felt that bitter and incomprehensible demoralization, and I felt that on my couch one day after I had moved out on my own, and I had just had enough. I was just done. I had tried so long to quit drinking. I'd been, you know, in my past, I'd been all over the world. I've been to so many spiritual places. I've been to Rome. I've been to Assisi. I've been to Medjugorje. I've been to Lourdes. I've been to Mexico City. I've been to all these places where all these wonderful things were supposed to happen. You know, and we talk about it in my faith, my denomination, the Catholic Church. And I remember going to all these places when I'd go there, and I'd go, okay, God, I'm here, you know, give me the key, you know, give me the ticket, you know, I'm ready, you know. And and that searching and yearning for that spiritual connection with my higher power and not getting it, you know. And going through all that, and I've had dinner with some people that they're called the visionaries, the apparition of the Virgin Mary in the Catholic Church. It's a whole story, but anyway, I've had dinner with these people right at the table with them, and still nothing. But I had to go through all that so I could go through the spiritual experience and have the spiritual awakening that's got me sober today, thanks to the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know, as far as going through that moment and hitting my knees and feeling the white light experience that you have, or the lightning bolt that it talks about, and having that obsession removed, you know, the obsession of the drink removed at that moment. It's the most powerful thing I've ever been through in my entire life. I remember the day before I'd woke up from off the couch, and I was going to get my daughter, and I'd overslept, and I was racing down the East-West Connector, and I came up to the light where I was supposed to turn on Cooper Lake, and I slid, and I accidentally hit somebody in the back of the car. Didn't really do any damage, but I tapped them, and I was still hungover, and I remember I could still smell the alcohol myself even to this day, and I was like, I'm going to jail. I know this is the time I'm going to jail. Finally, they're going to get me. And I pulled over, and a cop came up, and I guess he felt bad because of my leg situation, and he goes, no, just stay in the car, don't worry about it. And I got off, and that was the day before all this happened. And I just felt so bad. Like it talks about the bitter and incomprehensible demoralization that you feel, and it just the shame and the guilt and the remorse, it was just so intense, and I was just so tired. I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. I was just done. And I hit my knees on the couch that day, and I just said, God, I've just had enough. I'm just please help me. That's the first time I hit my knees and actually meant it, you know? I mean, I just wanted to be done with all. I didn't want to do this anymore. I didn't want to put my family through it. I lost everybody. And that whole thing came over me. It was like it was just this wave. And I was like, and I felt it. And I was just like, that God shot. And I was like, and I knew then I was like, okay, all right. Okay, here we go. And I got up and I got dressed. And, you know, I'm a healthy guy now. I like to eat. and because I don't drink anymore, so that's what I do. But but I probably weighed all of about 130 pounds, and I remember getting up, and I was on my crutches, and I went to Publix right up the road up here. I live right down the street. And, you know, I told you I'd gone to some meetings, and I was coming in and out of the rooms. And I remember there was this one woman, that I'd met. And we didn't really know each other at the time, but she was always so kind to me every time I saw her. Every time I was anywhere, despite being drunk or intoxicated, she'd always say, "Hey, Daniel, how you doing?" "I'm good." You know, knowing I'm not. I'm getting out of my car at Publix. I've got on the shirt barely hanging on. I'm like got my hat pulled down. I'm on my crutches. I'm hopping inside praying nobody sees me. And I hear somebody go, "Daniel?" And I don't think anything about it. And I hear another, "Daniel." And I look up, and there she is. And she's like, "Where have you been? We've been praying for you. We've been looking for you. You know, what's going on? Are you okay? What's going on? You know, we love you." And she just grabs me and hugs me. And I'd already had the experience I had in my house not an hour before. But then God places this woman in my higher power places this woman in my life right in front of me in Publix parking lot. And to this day, I have so many moments like that. I can tell you so many stories where I've met people in the Publix parking lot. And had I call it my God portal. Like if I'm having a bad time, I don't go to church, I go to Publix. I mean, that's where I go, because I know I'm going to meet somebody up there that touches my life some way or another. And I've met some remarkable people. I mean there are no coincidences, right? And I meet so many people up there, and I've met some people that are handicapped. I've met some people that, not only there, I've met people at Costco, Walmart. I meet people all the time, and it's just, you know, it's just that place. You know, everybody has a spot, right? Some people like to go hiking to get in touch. You know, and I do too. I like to go to all kinds of places to get right sized and get centered and get humbled and have my moment. You know, and get back on the beam, so to speak. But that's what happened to me. You know, at that moment. So anyway, so as my life today now, you know, it's been almost 8 years. And for the most part, I've had, you know, I told you my relationships with my family were a little troubled. And I told you I come from a long list of alcoholics, and including some of those members that are in my family, and a large part of my family actually relocated to Atlanta throughout the years. I'm very fortunate to have my sister here. She's also in the program. I know she doesn't mind me saying, you know, telling you that, because I've asked her and she said it's okay. She's got 16 years. My brother-in-law, who she's married to, has 26. I have another uncle that's here in Atlanta. He's got 27. My uncle, who gave me my first big book right here, he's also got a number of years in the program, and he's the enforcer in the family. If this guy shows up, you know you're in trouble. And he came up to Atlanta from Florida and took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can't be thankful enough to this day. Throughout the time and throughout the years, you know, I've learned, you know, to make amends with all those people that I've harmed. And, you know, one of the stories that I always talk about was, you know, my dad dated a woman when he was in high school, and I actually ended up dating her daughter in high school. So, you know, it's just small town, you know, whatever. We're from Tennessee. Get it? Anyway, so my father had passed away, and you know, my mom was like, you know, you should really go home and, you know, be there, you know, in his place. And I'd always kept in touch. Her name was Stacy, and I'd always kept in touch with her mom through the years. And then I went home, and this town I'm from, like I said, everybody knows everybody. And if somebody dies, everybody goes to the funeral, and you see everybody, and, you know, you're always there. And I had about 3 or 4 years of sobriety under my belt, and I'd gone back home, and everybody knew back home I was a drunk. Everyone knew what a train wreck I was, and how much. And I keep in mind, I caused a lot of damage in that town, and didn't nobody want to see me for a long time. And finally, you know, people had seen things. I'm on Facebook, so they see that I'm sober and my life's going better and everything else. So, and just being back in touch with my friends and telling them how things are going and whatnot, and with my dad's friends also. And I got to go home and be there in his place. Anyway, I also used that opportunity to make amends to some people when I was back home. So I sought those people out and were able to make some proper amends. And it was such a joy and an ability to do that and kind of heal those relationships, not only with friends, but with family members. And I remember being at the funeral, at the wake, at the service for his high school sweetheart's husband who had passed away, and just the number of people that came up after the funeral and said, "Daniel, you know, your dad would be so proud of you," because that's the one regret that I had, because I was such a piece of shit that I couldn't help my father when he was dying, you know? That's the kind of alcoholic I was. I got plenty of time. I remember one time he had fallen on the floor, because with ALS you lose your ability, your motor functions, to be able to walk and to move and whatnot. And he had a robotic chair, and he was coming out of the restroom in his chair, and he fell out of his chair. And like I said, my dad played football, as a huge guy. And I was so still drunk and just so incapable of doing anything, I couldn't even pick my father up off the floor. My mom had to come downstairs, call the fire department. They're looking at me like, what a waste. You know, just get out of the way. We got this. It's been such a, I still hold on to it. Still very painful for me, but to be able to be present for him now, and to be there for not only, you know, for him in those types of situations, you know, I know he looks down on me now, you know. I know he's proud of me. I know I'm okay with that, you know. I'm so thankful to be able to be present for my family, to be present for my mom. You know, it talks about, you know, a doctor, you know, talks about in the big book, him stealing from his wife, you know, and I was stealing from my mother. I'm living at home, stealing money from her, right? Just like in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, so he could go buy his drink, so he could, you know, soothe his obsession. I was doing the same thing. If I wasn't stealing from her, I was stealing with my friend who I lived on the couch. He had opened up his home to me, and I'm stealing from him. I've since been able to, you know, not only to make those amends, but to make those proper amends in completion. You know, the financial amends also. I can never repay my mother for all the things that she's done for me, but I try every day. For the longest time, I was upset. I held on to resentment, like somehow this was her fault, you know, for some things that had happened, and I was just, you know, I was such a bad person. I was just so wrong. And in 2018, I'd gone through an emotional bottom, the emotional roller coaster, and I, while I'd had some time in sobriety, but I came out of that without drinking. I'd become a dry drunk. I'd stopped going to meetings. I'd stopped doing all the things they talk about in the big book. When you stop doing it, you know, you become that dry drunk again. But but thankful by the grace of God, I stayed sober and I was able to come back into the program, and all the members welcomed me back with open arms, with love and affection and tolerance and compassion, like it talks about. And I remember going to my first AA roundup here in Atlanta, the Atlanta Roundup, and I can't say enough great things about the Atlanta Roundup. If you ever get an opportunity to go, I highly recommend it. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever done in my life. And I heard a guy tell my story, and it was just, it was amazing. And he talked about his relationship with his mother. And I'd never really heard someone tell my story before until I heard that man tell his. And the very next day, I got to have breakfast with him. It was just a complete coincidence, right? Or there are no coincidences, right? It just happened. I'm sitting there. He comes down. And he goes, hey, you mind if I have breakfast with you? And I was like, absolutely. And I sat there, and I told him about how he told my story. And I cried. And you know, he just listened, you know. And it was just the most amazing thing I've ever been through in my life. And I was able to... able to have that moment. And he talked about the healing, the relationship with his mother. You know, he said, you know, my sponsor told me to date my mother, and I heard that, and it just, boom, it just dawned on me. And I immediately took that and I applied that in my affairs, and you know, with my mom. And I, you know, we were talking tonight. She called me. She's like, "You want to go to dinner?" And I was like, "I would love to. I've got to go to Ridgeview to tell my story. How about we do it tomorrow night at 5:00?" She was like, "Okay, sounds good." And I've got that date with my mom tomorrow night, so I'm able. You know, I'm just trying to. I know I'm skipping around a lot, but I'm just trying to tell this how it impacts my life. But I'm able to be present, and able to be there for my mom. And I've never, it's my relationship with my mom's doing a complete 180, and I cannot be happier. And I know that's the son that I always wanted to be. Now, on top of which, you know, I had gone through a lot in my children's life, and I swore to myself when I was growing up, I'd never put my children through the things that I'd gone through. And I was able to make amends with my daughter. And you know, and my son too, and I can't ask for a better relationship I've ever had in my entire life with my kids through making those amends and being able to be present in their lives. And if you'd asked me 15 years ago, are you going to be at a softball field on a Saturday and Sunday in the middle of summer in 118 degrees or however it feels outside, I'd tell you, you're absolutely crazy. I'm not going to be doing that. Well, guess where I'm at? Right now, you know, every Saturday, I'm Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, I'm at a softball practice, or in the weekends I'm at a softball tournament. And it's some of the greatest things I've ever done in my entire life to be there for her, you know, and be that father that I wanted to be in my children's lives. And it's we're like two peas in a pod, man. It's awesome. And you know, my son, he likes doing certain things. I'm able to be present, be in his life also as well. And that's one of the gift and one of the blessings of this program. And I keep things honest with them. I talk to them about my past. I talk to them about my disease, because I want them to be aware also of what's going on in, you know, in my life. And they always ask me, you know, about the meetings, and they were going to come here tonight, but they had something to go do with their friends, and I'm totally okay with that. And but you know, we got to take anyway all the blessings and the promises that have just come true in our lives and in my life now. I couldn't even imagine. I told you I lost so many jobs before, but one of the main things that I've found now, you know, I'm able to hold down a job, and I'm actually employable, and I'm a grateful employee, and I'm very humble. I'd finally gotten back into the equipment industry after a long hiatus, and I'd gone back to work, and I wasn't really sure how that outcome was going to go, and I just prayed about it and prayed about it and prayed about it. And finally, I'd been interviewing with this company for a number of years, from the time I was still using and drinking to the, you know, up until recently, and I finally landed that job. You know, that's a miracle of promises God's working in my life, and that's come true for me. And I've just had so, you know, that's my life now, and that's how it is. And another thing I'm able to do too is I'm able to be honest not only with my family, and I always say this before I try to wrap things up, is I used to lie to my doctors all the time, right? I'd go to the doctor when I was drinking and using, they're like, "You okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm good." You sure? Yeah, I'm good. You know, I lied to somebody over here when I came in. No, I'm not using and drinking. And she knew I was drinking. I just didn't talk to her about the drugs. But she knew, you know, they were down to take a drug test on me, you know, when I walked in. But, you know, I think I still lied about it. But anyway, I'm able to be honest about that now. And, you know, one of the greatest gifts that I've got is that ability to be honest with everybody. I don't have to lie anymore. I don't have to cheat. I don't have to steal. I can just be me, you know, and not be ashamed of the person I used to be. But like I said, I always tell this story before I wrap it up, but I have a wonderful relationship with my doctor. And, you know, as there are several doctors, I'm sure, you know, in Atlanta that are in the program, but my doctor and I keep it real. He's one of the greatest guys I've ever had a relationship with. And I go in for my checkup, and he always asks me the same three questions. He's like, "Are you smoking?" And I go, "Nope." He goes, "You drinking anymore?" And I go, "Nope." He goes, "You still going to those meetings?" And I say, "Yep." He said, "Good, because that's the only thing." He goes, "It's the only thing I've ever found that ever works." That's all I got. Thanks for my time.